This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Saturday, March 16th, 2024. I'm Chad Berkley. TikTok, should it be banned? Congress makes a move. And surprise departures from the House.
340-some people, I think 350, that voted for this, Democrats, Republicans alike. That sends a pretty strong signal that this is something that is urgent, needs to get done, and the Senate just simply can't ignore.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Are American relations with Israel fraying over the war in Gaza, or just for some Democrats?
Certainly within the administration, they're pushing back. They want to really make sure that civilians in Gaza are protected to a higher degree. But at the same time, I don't think there's real concern that the level of support will actually stop.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. I'm here with Fox News congressional correspondent and my colleague, Aisha Hosni. Aisha, you've covered the TikTok story very closely, and you had a big get this week. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, we've been sort of searching for TikTok CEO Shou Chu. We'd heard that he was going to be on Capitol Hill this week, sort of lobbying for really essentially trying to kill this House bill to force TikTok to sell. And we finally saw him this week, and we chased him down, and I got to ask him some questions. And the number one question I had to ask was, why doesn't ByteDance just sell, just do what the bill sets out to do? Because he continuously says that, you know, the bill is a ban, that it's going to ban the app nationwide, which is not true. So I just asked him, why not just sell? And he told me, look, it's not feasible in the time span that the bill lays out. I think it's about 6 months it gives to TikTok or ByteDance to find a different owner. And he says it's not feasible. To which the House China Competition Committee, I think, had a very interesting response. And they basically said, so TikTok is admitting that it would rather sacrifice its users and revenue than sever ties with a genocidal communist regime. Those were the words from the committee. So this argument goes on and on and on as now this bill is sort of stalled in the Senate. And we don't know what Chuck Schumer is going to do. He's just said that they're reviewing the bill. But beyond that, sort of up in the air whether or not this actually will come to the fore for a vote. A few Democrats have told us, including Mark Warner, who is the Intel chair, that he believes that it might be changed a little, the language, but he does think that eventually we'll see this come up for a vote on the floor. But the biggest, I think, part of the story, I think I was surprised by, and many others were, was the bipartisan vote in the House. I mean, you're talking about 340-some people, I think 350, that voted for this, Democrats, Republicans alike. That sends a pretty strong signal that this is something that is urgent, needs to get done, and the Senate just simply can't ignore.
Yeah, that was a pretty amazing vote there, 352-65 opposed, one member voting present. And talk to us for a moment, Aisha, about the idea that when you get such a large vote in the House of Representatives, how that places pressure on the Senate. You know, this is a big bipartisan vote here to do something. I mean, Maria Cantwell, she did not exactly slam the door. She's the Democratic senator from Washington State, but chairs the Commerce Committee here. You know, Chuck Schumer has been a little more circumspect about this, but Cantwell, she didn't outright rule out taking up the House bill.
Right. And like I said, I mean, 300 is not nothing. It's definitely a message to the Senate that this is very important, to the House, to, you know, members of both parties. I mean, there were definitely progressives and others, your libertarians, that felt like this was sort of, you know, not a constitutional bill. Mm-hmm. And they had their own reasons for not supporting it. But I mean, for the vast majority, they want something done on this bill. Now, there are those in the Senate that agree with that consensus that something should be done about TikTok, certainly because of its ties to the CCP. But the language they might want to go back and read over and change a little bit so that it, in their minds, is not problematic. What I think is interesting is this sort of these mixed signals that you're getting from the two presumptive nominees, right, of both parties. You've got President Biden, who is willing to sign this House bill. The White House supports it. But the Biden campaign is actively using the app to reach out to young voters. And it's working. And even Mark Warner said, you know, he thought it was mixed messages here. And then you've got the former President Trump, who's sort of flip-flopped his stance, too, first signing that executive order to ban TikTok in 2020. Now he's opposed to a nationwide ban for various reasons. He thinks that, you know, all those people might turn to Facebook, and then Facebook becomes incredibly powerful. I think
his statement was remarkable about that. Yeah,
it was. Yeah. And I think that's really a really interesting dynamic going on in the background, too, in this election season, where when you think about it, a lot of young people, Chad, get their news from TikTok. And we're only about 8 months away from an election. You would think that Congress would want to do something about it if they really do feel like the CCP is controlling this app.
You know, and that's the amazing thing here. And here's the statement from former President Trump. He said, if you get rid of TikTok, Facebook, and Zucker schmuck will double their business. I don't want Facebook, who cheated in the last election, doing better. They are a true enemy of the people, exclamation point. And that's what he put on Truth Social. You know, there's two other dynamics in this I want to ask you about that I was struck by in this whole debate. Politics do make strange bedfellows. You had these very liberal members, Robert Garcia, a Democrat from Southern California, yeah, and others, who opposed the bill because they said, you know, creators and people who, are trying to get their message out, or this silences certain alternative opinions and things. And it was a broader First Amendment argument that he was making. But here's something else that I picked up on as well, is that there are people who, you know, who are very suspect of what happens in Washington, people mm-hmm. who are very suspect of Congress. And I started to wonder if maybe Congress, with this big overwhelming vote, was completely out of step with the voters, to say nothing of the people who just use TikTok on a daily basis and see this as, oh, this is big government coming in and right. encroaching on us once again. But that they viewed this, people who are on the far right, as a big conspiracy again, because they don't trust social media to start with. But they're like, oh, what is being posted under First Amendment grounds that might be sort of conspiratorial or something? That's going out there, that this is an effort to tramp on this. There's something out there that they don't want us to know. And I found that to be a very interesting narrative.
Yeah, you're right. There's two dynamics, right? The suspicious, and then those that are thinking about this politically. For example, Ro Khanna, I got to talk to him right after the House vote, and he basically said, you know, why? Why would you want to upset young people? 170 million people use this app. That's incredible. This is the most popular platform out there. I mean, you and I are not on it just because we just have so much going on. But I mean, you think about the House taking on Goliath. And so he's saying, like, look, there's other ways, less restrictive ways of achieving the goal that we're all trying to achieve. We're all on the same page here. But to basically, essentially pass something that would ban TikTok if they don't divest, why would you do that? And to, you know, to be honest, risk the potential of losing those young people come November. Why? That's what he was asking. On the other hand, you have people like Nancy Mace and Marjorie Taylor Greene, as you said, who are just thinking this is not constitutional and this is like overreaching. So, yes, those dynamics, I think, are going to play out in the Senate. And that's where the Senate might take weeks, months, who knows? I mean, this doesn't seem to feel like it's going to be done in a matter of days.
No.
And that's where it gets a little tricky here, right? I mean, the longer this stalls in the Senate, the better chance Shou Chew of TikTok has to sort of undermine this.
And maybe that's what they want to do, is maybe take their time in the Senate. You know, there's an old saying here that the Senate is where the House's hot coffee cools, and so this is the hot coffee. You know, this bill came together very, very fast in
the House
of Representatives, a markup session very quick, went to the floor very quick, passed very quickly, didn't even go to the Rules Committee. So maybe this is it cooling, and again, maybe the Senate might want to kind of take a step back. And no one has said this directly to me, but you know, maybe see if Chu can sell it, or the Chinese government can sell it, and then they don't have to deal with this problem because they've sent the message in the House of Representatives.
Well, or maybe they want to do their own work, right? And there are some lawmakers that would love to see Chu come to the Senate side and would love to do a hearing and have an opportunity to question and grill him directly before they decide to do anything. So we could see that, too. We could see a round two of Chu on the Hill.
And I'm sure you will be there to get him, because you did a great job with that.
I will certainly try. Thank you. Thank you. What I also think is interesting is that several lawmakers have also told me, look, we've got other more pressing matters to attend to, which includes obviously funding the government, which is always a pressing matter. But also foreign aid is something that is being talked about. And a very big speech this week by the majority leader, Chuck Schumer, who for the first time was incredibly critical of Israel and made some pretty harsh remarks and sort of almost calling for a change in government in Israel.
Yeah, so Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, I mean, he is the highest ranking Jewish official in the American government. And they billed this in his office that he was going to make a major policy statement about Israel. He certainly did that, basically saying that Benjamin Netanyahu is now being controlled by the extreme right and that he doesn't want Israel to become a pariah on the world stage, you know, because the view of Israel now is much different than it was, considering how hard they've struck back at Hamas on this. And they say, of course, we have a right to defend ourselves. And so that was rather remarkable to have Chuck Schumer come in and do this. Now, keep in mind that there have been criticisms from the left in the Democratic Party about how they have handled the Middle East situation, certainly directed at the president. I wonder if maybe Schumer was trying to maybe, you know, guide the argument there a little bit, you know, and take some of the heat off the president and maybe suggest to the president maybe this is the policy we should be taking, and that will mollify some of those on the left who are very concerned about what's happening in Gaza and with Hamas and humanitarian issues there. So that's one part of that. Brian Schatz, who's a Democratic member from Hawaii and also Jewish, he commented that after the speech that this was, quote, gutsy. So he applauded him. Peter Welch, a Democrat from Vermont, who was, you know, one of just a couple of Democrats who voted against the overall Ukraine aid bill that had money in there for Taiwan and Israel, of course, you know, some weeks ago. He came up to Schumer after the speech and congratulated him. Peter Welch, after they passed that bill, got on the floor early on that Tuesday morning some weeks ago and said, you know, the reason that he voted against the bill was because how the aid was going to Israel, and he didn't like how Israel was comporting itself. So this is winning some plaudits in certain sectors of the Democratic Party. Now, you talk about the criticism from Republicans. You have some moderate Democrats, first of all, who were opposed and didn't like what Schumer did. But then you have Republicans who saw this opening. Aisha, I don't think I have ever seen the minority leader or the other leader on the other side criticize on the floor immediately after a speech and give such a harsh rebuke of the other leader on the floor. And that is exactly what Mitch McConnell did on the floor the other day. He said that we shouldn't be meddling in the affairs of Israel. They are a sovereign nation. He thought that we're telling their voters what to do. He really didn't like that. Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, said as much as well. I mean, this was one of those seminal moments. But again, if you parse this in the internal politics of the Democratic Party, they have a problem post October 7th. And so, you know, this is both President Biden and Senator Schumer trying to figure out how do you thread this needle. And keep in mind that Schumer has an awful lot of Jewish American constituents who are very supportive of Israel and what they've been doing post 10/7 here, and probably are very frustrated with him right now. So again, and maybe it's easier for Chuck Schumer to do it in this way than it is for President Biden to do it
in this way.
In an election.
And I wonder too. And obviously, the White House had to know what remarks Schumer was about to make.
Yes.
But I mean, just a few days ago, we were all talking about how the president was caught on a hot mic on the floor of the State of the Union, telling his colleagues that, you know, he and Netanyahu here soon have to come to have a come to Jesus moment, a meeting. And you heard, you know, his colleagues and Pete Buttigieg was there and others sort of laughing at that comment. So that obviously didn't go over well with a lot of folks. And then you have this speech a few days later. I think it is a political problem for Democrats, especially in states like Michigan, where you had, you know, almost 10% uncommitted vote recently by Arab and Muslim Americans. These are people that I talk to weekly. And I've talked to Arab and Muslims, Arab Americans and Muslim Americans in the Midwest, down in the South, in Texas. And what they're telling me is their relationship to the Democratic Party is over. I mean, they are so beyond angered by what has happened and the inaction in their perspective by this White House that that relationship is now over. Even if it's 8 months away, the election, they don't see themselves even going to the ballot box. I'm not saying that they're going to go vote for Trump, but they don't see themselves in any way, shape, or form supporting the current president. So that's something that he has to also figure out how to navigate.
That is a real danger for the president in a swing state like Michigan, which he won barely last time around, but won 15 electoral votes. There's about 400,000 Arab American or Muslim voters in Michigan. And again, if you lose that block, I mean, that's one of the reasons that he won that block in 2020, frankly. So if there's no way to bridge that gap, and of course you had people vote uncommitted there and in Minnesota a couple of weeks ago, you know, that is a gaping hole in that coalition for the Democrats.
Another problem in November is going to be for House Republicans. This has been a rough road for them this past year and a half, and for Speaker Mike Johnson, who a few days ago was pretty surprised by Ken Buck's news that he's going to resign immediately from Congress. It really, really, really hurts Johnson's numbers now.
Yeah, well, you always hear me say it's all about the math, and it really is about the math. Now, a couple of things on this. So, effectively, Ken Buck leaves at the end of next week. The GOP majority goes down to two votes. It's been at two votes, but, you know, now if there's a tie, then it's over. So that, you know, on the floor. So, but if you look at the delta in terms of the difference of members, there's about a 4 or 5 member difference. So it's not like the House is going to flip eminently. But here's the interesting thing about this. Ken Buck was going to retire at the end of the Congress. Then he made this kind of snap decision that I'm going to leave at the end of next week. So that number goes down. At the end of April, there is a special election in Western New York for the seat held by Brian Higgins of Buffalo. If Democrats win that seat, then the margin goes down to 1. Republicans might get a seat back here if they win the special election in California for Kevin McCarthy's seat in May. But again, you are one untimely death, God forbid, away from something happening. You might have other people say, hey, you know, I have an opportunity to leave the Hill. Why am I putting up with all these headaches here?
Right.
I can make a big paycheck and maybe go. I mean, there have been some people indicate to me that maybe the House, it might flip in the middle of the Congress. That's never happened. And again, as I point out, that 4 or 5 vote margin, you know, the total delta there between how many Democratic seats there are and how many Republican seats there are, you know, that takes a lot there. But, you know, somebody said to me, I would not be surprised if you get past the election. So you're in the lame duck Congress here. And then the House flips because people are like, you know, we lost or won or whatever we did. And here's my opportunity to start on this new job or this new paycheck. Or why do I put up with all the headaches here? We can't get anything done. We're frustrated. Members are at each other's throats. This is why we almost had physical violence up here a couple of months ago between Kevin McCarthy and Tim Burchett and others. People really don't think this is a nice place to be anymore. And so, again, that would be pretty wild. We've had the Senate flip in the middle of a Congress, but not the House of Representatives, Aisha. And again, it's that tension. I mean, tell us what you're seeing in that.
There is absolute tension, and there's frustration, and you know, people come here to make a difference. You know, there's a lot of folks here that come here for the right reasons, and you know, Congressman Gallagher, for example, the chairman of the China Competition Committee, as he was pushing this TikTok bill forward, I asked him, you know, if this passes in the House with an overwhelming majority, and let's say it passes in the Senate, and this gets signed, you know, into law, Would it make you think twice about leaving? Would it make you want to stay because you got something done? And he just laughed at me and he said, no, I think Congress will survive, you know, even after I'm gone. But I think he's one of those that is probably ready for something new because yeah. of, you know, just sort of feeling like, you know, Congress really doesn't accomplish much. I had a private conversation with one lawmaker who is also leaving at the end of his term. And I asked him, you know, why are you leaving? And he said, have you seen what's been happening in the House? I mean, we can't get anything done. It's just nothing but chaos. And he told me that he expects even more people to decide that they're not running for re-election. So, I mean, there's this sort of feeling, and you started to feel the frustration a lot, right, when Speaker McCarthy was ousted, and people were getting really, really, really angry about, you know, the motion of AK, and they wanted that to change.
We started to see it during the Speaker's election at the beginning
right.
of the Congress.
Absolutely, or, you know, absolutely.
Yeah, January 3rd.
So it's sort of like this motion of AK has really been a thorn in their side this entire time. So, which I was just reading a report that apparently they're open to changing that come November or after November. So we'll see if that happens. But I think there is absolutely a sense of anger and frustration and just restlessness and certainly a surprise that so many of these rising stars within the Republican ranks have decided, you know, to throw in the towel. But I think it also tells this really interesting story, Chad, of where the Republican Party is headed towards as we head towards November, because there is a split, you know, of two ideologies, and you have those institutional Republicans. And then you have the MAGA Republicans, people who want to see changes like this in the party and who are frankly happy that some of these people are leaving. And you're seeing a little bit of that now in bubble up in the Senate as well. Now that Mitch McConnell is no longer going to be leader, there's sort of this opening for, you know, for the party to shift in a new direction. So all of that is sort of playing as well in the background of this. But I think in the next 8 months here, certainly after November, Congress and certainly the GOP might look very, very different.
You know, and the other thing about this, you know, you could have a scenario because of the people who are departing the House where President Biden wins re-election, yet there are more so-called MAGA Republicans in the House. Even if they lose control of the House, that could be what the Republican conference is. You certainly have that dynamic in the Senate with Mitch McConnell stepping down from leadership and other people retiring, people in the middle, you know, Joe Manchin. I mean, it doesn't mean that the MAGA movement goes away if former President Trump does not win re-election. They might have more forces here on Capitol Hill. Something I was looking at the other day was looking at J.D. Vance, the Republican senator from Ohio, who there was a profile on him in Politico talking about kind of the new MAGA and maybe even a different type of MAGA than what former President Trump was able to offer. So this is what's going to be very interesting to see, not so much what the numbers are, but understand where people stand who make up the Congress in the next year or two.
Absolutely. It's going to be wild.
Well, yes, absolutely. Well, Aisha, again, kudos on the big get this week. Excellent
Thank
work.
You.
Ace reporting. And we will visit soon.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
The week began with discussion about Israel in light of President Biden saying in an interview that a red line for him would be Israel going into the southern Gaza city of Rafah in a way that results in many more Palestinian deaths. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said from the White House when questioned whether future aid to Israel is conditioned upon how Rafah is handled, said those reports are based on speculation and he wouldn't comment on hypotheticals, adding,
a ceasefire is on the table today for 6 weeks to be built on into something more enduring if Hamas would simply release women, wounded, and elderly. And the fact that they will not do so says a lot to me about Hamas's regard for innocent Palestinian civilians.
The next day, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said in a speech on the Senate floor,
"The fourth major obstacle to peace is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has all too frequently bowed to the demands of extremists."
Schumer, the highest-ranking Jewish politician in the U.S., said Netanyahu's been too willing to tolerate the civilian casualties in Gaza, and that as a result, support for Israel is falling.
"I believe a new election is the only way to allow for a healthy and open decision-making process about the future of Israel."
Several Republicans expressed outrage, including Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
"It is grotesque and hypocritical for Americans who hyperventilate about foreign interference in our own democracy to call for the removal of a democratically elected leader of Israel. This is unprecedented."
And Friday, President Biden was asked about Schumer's remarks.
"I'm not going to elaborate on the speech. He made a good speech, and I think he expressed a serious concern shared not only by him, but by many Americans."
Multiple Israeli politicians issued statements rejecting Schumer's remarks, but do they highlight shifting opinions about Israel among Democrats? A recent Fox News poll found while 43% of those surveyed support Israel in the conflict, 42% side more with the Palestinians.
Absolutely, are they fraying, certainly with the White House. And they have been for the last couple of months or so.
Benjamin Hall is a Fox News correspondent who's covered war. He was severely injured 2 years ago in Ukraine and has since reported from Israel as well.
Seeing Chuck Schumer call for elections in our closest ally in the Middle East, a democratic country, is the first time I know of something like that happening. I mean, it is a big move. They're in the middle of a conflict right now against a terror group called Hamas, and there are calls for there to be elections. Now, look, I do understand. I've been on the ground. I was there recently in Israel, that there are concerns about Netanyahu, that he's reached out to the far right. Nevertheless, he has been elected in. The next elections aren't until 2026. So to somehow start calling for another election just seems to me a really dangerous move, frankly, to be making over here.
And Israelis, I mean, polling seems to indicate that while Israelis support, I guess, a lot of what Netanyahu's talking about regarding Gaza, that they don't necessarily support him. And a lot of that has to do with the war, with how this even happened in the first place.
Yes, a lot of questions about how this was happening. And perhaps were the eyes of the military watching the border, were they distracted? Because there had been a lot of protests across Israel over Netanyahu's plan to change the judiciary system. And so a lot of people thought that even at that point, the Netanyahu should perhaps call another election. But After the October 7th attack, the feeling was at least the country was totally unified on having to get rid of the threat of Hamas. One of the places that there is also disagreements is what is the number one priority? And I've spoken to a number of family members of the hostages being held inside Gaza, and there is concern that the priority is getting rid of Hamas rather than bringing the hostages home.
Right.
And most people think that, sadly, it's going to be very hard to do both. And, you know, the military is waiting to go into Rafah at the moment. The ceasefire deals have not happened. It looks like they're going into Rafah. It looks like they will do their best to defeat Hamas, at least militarily. But that, sadly, means that the chances of hostages coming back is getting lower and lower. And that's why quite a few people in Israel are upset.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. But I also want your thoughts about some of the continued, I guess, tension out of Washington regarding this relationship we have with Israel, because Israelis from multiple political sides heard what President Biden said this week and heard what Leader Schumer said this week, and they were upset. I mean, opposition leader Benny Gantz said Israel's a strong democracy. Only its citizens will determine its future, and any external intervention in the matter is incorrect and unacceptable. Former PM Naftali Bennett, who is not exactly on the side of Netanyahu, said, you know, with the threat of terrorism on its way to the West, it would be best if the international community would assist Israel in its war. Is Israel preparing for the possibility of less U.S. support in the future?
Yes and no. The fact is, yes, they are afraid, and people I speak to say we're concerned that certainly within the administration they're pushing back. They want to really make sure that civilians in Gaza are protected to a higher degree. But at the same time, I don't think there's real concern that the level of support will actually stop. It does feel as if President Biden is making quite a lot of noise about it at the moment, but he knows politically what would happen if he started to reduce weapons going to Israel, if he really tightened up what was happening there. Look, he has said that there could perhaps be, it would be a red line, is what President Biden said, if the Israeli military go into Rafah, and that perhaps they could hold back some military assistance. But the question is, he said, first of all, that would not be the Iron Dome to protect
right.
them. But the only thing it could be, perhaps some of the guided weapons that they are giving, that the Israelis are using inside Gaza. But if they reduce those, Israel is going to start using the non-targeted weapons that they have lots of. And mm-hmm. so the irony is that there's nothing that Biden can really stop that is going to affect the Israelis in a big way. So, yes, they don't like the way the tone is going, but they haven't frankly listened to anything the administration has said so far. Biden has been saying for a long time, you must watch out for this, you must do this differently. And frankly, the Israelis haven't really listened. And I don't think Benjamin Netanyahu is frankly planning on doing so at the moment. So it's interesting. The one thing that they have agreed to do is give a lot more aid to Gaza. And I think we will see over the coming weeks a lot more trucks going in. But I don't think they're really concerned that military aid is going to actually stop.
Let's talk about the fluidity of the situation on the ground. It sounds like there are reports indicating that Qatar and Egypt have been pressuring Hamas to reach some kind of deal that involves a ceasefire here, and that the pressure is stronger than it was before. But Israel has said their demands for more prisoners and that Israel leave the area entirely are not going to happen. And on the other side of things, you have on Friday Prime Minister Netanyahu approving plans for an operation in Rafah. We don't know exactly what those plans would be, but this is the place where many Palestinians fled to the south,
yeah.
when Israel was operating in the north. It seems like this is sort of a very tense moment, you know, after 5 months of all of this.
It is a tense moment. And Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israelis have said that we have cleared most of the north. And to do that, we had to push many people in Gaza down to the south and to Rafah. Now, about 1.3 million people are down there. And I think the plan is to now have to move them up north or to the middle around Khan Yunis so they can go inside Rafah, where they say about a quarter of Hamas remains inside. Now, Benjamin Netanyahu said the red line for him is making sure that October 7th doesn't happen again. And the only way to do that, he says, is to go into Rafah and get rid of Hamas. The other important thing about Rafah is that it borders the Egyptian border, which is where so many of the weapons and the tunnels do come across. And it is key for the Israelis that they do need to control that, both now as well as for the future. So that's why I think it's almost certain that they will go in. They just have to find a way of moving some of the civilians yeah. north. You mentioned the ceasefire. And what's really interesting is that they've been going back and forth. The Qataris, the Americans, the Egyptians have all been sitting down with the Israelis and Hamas. But the one point that they simply cannot agree on from the very beginning has been the total removal of Israeli soldiers from Gaza.
Right.
And Benjamin Netanyahu has said clearly, as have the IDF, that's never going to happen. And that is the one thing that Hamas says has to happen. The Israelis would happily exchange prisoners. You know, in, what was it, 15 years ago, they exchanged 1,000 Israeli prisoners for one, Palestinian prisoners,
right.
for one Israeli soldier. And included among those thousands was Sinwar, who was the current head of,
right.
Hamas.
So
they would. The current deal that was just put on the table today or yesterday, it was asking for 700 to 1,000 Palestinians to be released, 100 of them from high security. The Israelis would do that. You know, they've shown they would do that in the past, but what they will not agree on is total removal of all Israeli troops. And there's no movement there.
It sounds like both sides really are talking about something existential. Israel's saying we have to destroy you, and Hamas is saying, well, you're going to destroy us. Well, we've already told you we're going to destroy you. This sounds like there can't really be an end if both sides are committed to destruction, but one is committed to the destruction of a terrorist organization. And that brings me to this idea that the U.S. had said, or the U.S. officials had said, that they want out of Israel a more targeted special ops type response to go after Hamas and Rafah. And given that Israel is quite a moral army and drops leaflets and lets people know when activity is happening or has in the past, I'm sure Israel would love to have a more targeted operation and not kill people. But when Hamas is operating in a way in which they hide behind children mm-hmm. and people mm-hmm. in tunnels, How would you, like, how could the U.S. make this request that this be a more targeted operation? What would targeted even look like in this case?
It is the sad reality that Hamas knows that global attention, or rather global support, any support for Israel, is diminishing day by day. And that happens with the increased number of Palestinian civilians killed. And Hamas, to be honest, understands that civilians will be killed. In fact, for them, the higher the civilian death toll, the more people will come to their side. And that's why, as you said, they've used them as human shields. They hide under schools and hospitals. They put their tunnels there. So it puts Israel in a very, very difficult situation. What does targeted mean? It means going door to door with Israeli soldiers and knocking down those doors and trying to find the bad guys. And that leads to a very, very high number of Israeli deaths among their soldiers.
Yeah, that's a vulnerable place to be in.
Exactly. So that's what it's very hard for them to do. But look, there are no positive outcomes here at all. There are innocent civilian families inside Gaza being killed. There's no doubting that. But Hamas is the one who is using them as human shields, who is often not allowing them to flee certain areas so they can continue to hide behind them. And so it's a very hard decision that the Israelis have to make.
Finally, Ben, what do we know about the future involvement of other countries here? We know other countries have not opened their doors to Palestinian refugees. But Egypt and Qatar have been involved heavily in hostage negotiations. We've even heard about, like, Saudi Arabia being maybe involved in future plans. Like, what do we know about from other, I guess, Arab countries?
Yes, well, going back decades, you've had so many Gulf and Arab countries who all, you know, talk as loudly as they can about supporting the Palestinians, doing whatever they can, but none of them will take any Palestinians. None of them will have any camps for the moment. And I understand that Jordan, Lebanon doesn't want to because they already have millions of Palestinians and they have seen what it does to their economy. So they're very loud in complaining, but they don't offer many practical solutions. If you want to look at a solution for the future, you do need to figure out how Gaza can be rebuilt and under who. Let's assume that the Israeli Defense Forces do go into Rafah. Let's say they do get rid of most of Hamas military. What happens after that is the big question. Now, it does seem as if you need some kind of government in the middle, ruling party that can take the step forward. The Palestinian authorities, they're not really wanted in there. But if they were to work alongside the UAE or Egypt, or Gulf states, for example, then that perhaps does lead the way to something positive. The flip side of that is that the Israelis will never want any Arab soldiers inside Gaza to oversee the transition. So it's hard to see exactly how this will move forward. And I know it's all terrible and it's all pessimistic, but you have to hope, perhaps if Hamas was totally defeated, could this be the one opportunity to lead to something positive? If you think of all the billions and billions of dollars that has been spent in Gaza over the last two decades, if that had been spent positively and building up an economy, Gaza could have become a great success story and it could have been peaceful. So can we now make sure this is the beginning where that starts to happen? Well, it needs a lot of countries working together. It's going to be a very difficult one, but you've got to hope there's a small chance of that happening.
Benjamin Hall, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your insight.
Thanks, Jessica.
That'll do it for this edition of the Fox News Rundown from Washington. Tomorrow, my colleague Jared Halpern speaks with Washington Republican Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers about the House-approved bill that could result in a ban of TikTok. And he'll talk about the state of the presidential race, as both President Biden and former President Trump now have enough delegates for their respective nominations. I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.